Travel is great, but planning for travel can be time-consuming and difficult. That's where One Travel comes in. With One Travel, you'll find everything you need to book the perfect trip. Flights, hotels, cars, transportation, it's all right there. With One Travel, you can book online, via app, or even pick up the phone and talk to a travel advisor ready to help you make your selections. Visit onetravel.com/music or call 855-437-2154. Plan it, book it, live it. One Travel.
Take your family's best trip yet to Denver, where every stroll sparks a smile and where every moment becomes a memory. Denver, always welcome. Plan your getaway at visitdenver.com/summer.
I won't let my moderate to severe plaque psoriasis symptoms define me.
Emerge as you. In two clinical studies, Tremfya guselkumab, taken by injection, provided 90% clearer skin at 16 weeks in 7 out of 10 adults with moderate to severe plaque psoriasis. In a study, nearly 7 out of 10 patients with 90% clearer skin at 16 weeks were still clearer at 5 years. At 1 year and thereafter, patients and healthcare providers knew that Tremfya was being used. This may have increased results. Results may vary.
Serious allergic reactions may occur. Tremfya may increase your risk of infections and lower your ability to fight them. Before treatment, your doctor should check you for infections and tuberculosis. Tell your doctor if you have an infection or symptoms of infection, including fever, sweats, chills, muscle aches, or cough. Tell your doctor if you had a vaccine or plan to.
Emerge as you. Learn more about Tremfya, including important safety information, at Tremfya.com or call 1-877-578-3527. See our ad in Food & Wine magazine. For patients prescribed Tremfya, cost support may be available.
The most exciting part of a vacation stay at a home rental? Easy. It's being greeted upon arrival with a rusted lockbox affixed to the underside of a stranger's condo. Yeah, you simply twist knobs, click gears, jiggle it, and then rip it off its moorings, and voila! Your prize is a key to a questionable home rental and maybe tetanus. When you just want to get your vacation started by actually getting into your room, it matters where you stay. At Hilton, we deliver your key right to your phone on the Hilton Honors app. Hilton, for the stay.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Well, hello, John. Hello, Todd. It's another edition of Flight Safety Detectives. It's good to see you guys. I know that I was giving John grief, Todd, because you and him ended up doing a show and I was not present, which, you know, I figured he was going to try and slip one in because that way he can get these zingers in and not have any retaliation. But you know what? Paybacks are hell. So it's good to see you both. As always, I am in Colorado only temporarily. I'm heading out on another trip. And I know that, what, John, you're way south. You're down in, what, South Carolina, Florida, wherever, who knows, Tahiti. Where are you?
No, South Carolina, going to Newark tomorrow, and then back to South Carolina.
Yeah, well, that's good. I mean, Newark is a good place for you. Maybe you can help them, you know, bail out all the water that's probably still in the baggage area of Newark Airport.
Yeah, it's a swamp in more ways than one.
And where are you, Todd? Where are you hiding?
Well, on the outskirts of Boston, as usual. Not going anywhere this week.
Oh, well, come on. You know, the weather's changing, it's getting nice, and unfortunately the airports are a zoo, so maybe you do have a good plan of just staying there.
I have a local trip plan to get a lobster roll or two. That's about it.
Well, good. Well, we
sounds good.
Tastes even better.
Yeah, I'll bet. Absolutely. Well, we know that there's been a number of accidents this week. One was a prominent accident flown by Cape Air, Cessna 402, that ended up into the trees trying to make a landing at Provincetown Municipal Airport. And that's right in, John, and you, of course, Todd, that's right near your backyard. So, well, I think we're all familiar with Cape Air. They're operating both the 402Cs and they've just started to integrate in the new aircraft, the Technam aircraft, that are just a little bigger than those 402s, but they're a new generation of airplane. They too are piston aircraft. And unfortunately, this one was an older airplane, but it doesn't look like it was really the airplane at this point. So what do we know, gentlemen?
Well, Greg, before we get into that, let's remind everybody who's sponsoring this show. You know, so this show is being brought to everybody by PAMA, the Professional Aviation Maintenance Association, PAMA.org, if you want to get a hold of them. And it's also being brought to you by Avemco Insurance, the premium general aviation insurance carrier. So if you own a general aviation airplane and you're renewing, or if you just bought one and you need insurance, please give Avemco a call for a quote that you might be pleasantly surprised. Or if you're a CFI and you need insurance, or if you're a renter and need insurance,
yeah,
give Avemco a call. In fact, Avemco services the entire spectrum of general aviation aircraft in the insurance marketplace. So give them a call. It's 888-879-0389. Again, 888-879-0389 or avemco.com. And don't forget, if you just mentioned Flight Safety Detectives, you get a 5% discount on top of any other discounts you get. So give them a try. And now back to what we know about the accident.
Oh my God. One of these days we're going to professionally produce this show and not sound like a bunch of rookies sitting around talking. This is just too funny sometimes. I'm glad it's Sunday, or at least that's when we're recording this show. So I always need some entertainment from the both of you. So it's a good way to start.
Start the week. So we know the airplane was being operated by Cape Air. It was flight number 2072, flying from Boston to Provincetown. It was delayed coming out of Boston some 2 hours and 44 minutes. We don't know why at this point in time. There was plenty of bad weather around Provincetown. So it may have been a weather delay, but in any event, it was delayed 2:44. It finally took off at 3, I'm looking at my notes here, 4 minutes after 3, it took off and was heading sort of southeast out of Boston, heading to runway 7 in Provincetown. And Todd, you've picked up some additional facts from that. Why don't you share them with us?
Yes, one of the things about this is that it's unclear from the information we have whether or not this was diverted from Nantucket or whether the intended landing area was Provincetown. But in any case, it was going into the airport in Provincetown, which happens to be an untowered airport, about 3,500 feet long. There were weather reports both before and after the accident time that indicated that there was rain in the area. The report that was a timestamp about 5 minutes after the incident said that it was heavy rain. It's unclear whether there was rain happening at the time of the event. The one person who has spoken at length about what was happening during the landing was one of the passengers who was injured, who was said words to the effect of, they landed, it didn't look like they were going to be able to stop. And then the pilot pulled up. It wasn't clear whether it was pulling up just rotating or pulling up and left the ground. But the FAA did report that the airplane went through the airport fence and through some trees before coming to rest. Looking at photos on the ground of the day of the event and also some historical photos from Google Earth, there's about 300 to 400 feet of open area between the end of the runway and the initial tree line to the just to the right of center line where apparently this airplane hit. Whether this airplane was airborne when it struck the fence and the trees, or whether it was on the ground when it struck the fence and trees, that remains to be seen. The NTSB has, as of yet, not given any formal report as to what went on.
one of the things that we got to let's take this apart a little bit. Of course, everybody loves to turn to FlightAware and FlightRadar 24 and every other internet program to try and put the profiles together. And we've done the same thing while we're waiting to get better fidelity data. But when you look at the flight path from FlightRadar 24 versus the flight path of FlightAware, it would give you two different storylines. The FlightAware data shows that the airplane made an inbound turn directly to the airport versus the FlightRadar 24 data that shows a bit of a jog in that data. So it's not a straight line to the airport. If he was shooting the ILS to runway 7, of course, he would have joined the approach and been straight in. Now, you were talking, Todd, that there was weather that was reported 5 minutes before, 5 minutes after. There was indications of heavy rain. What the board's really going to have to do is dissect the weather on the approach. Even though it may not have been raining very hard at the airport, the pilot may have encountered heavy rain during the course of executing the ILS approach. We do know that there was rain at the airport. We know that this particular runway, like you said, was 3,500 feet long, but it's asphalt, so it's not grooved. That, John, sets us up for a hydroplaning event. And from my sources, I heard that the airplane likely landed long and started the hydroplane, which may have necessitated the decision by the pilot to, one, either try and stop and go off the end, or two, try to bail out of this and power up and pull up. And it sounds like the latter occurred based on one of the passenger statements and some of the physical evidence that would suggest that the pilot did power up, was trying to go around, and may have gotten the airplane airborne, but it wasn't of sufficient height to clear the fence or the trees 500-600 feet off the end of the runway.
I'd like to throw in a couple more things about this for those out there. This was an airline flight, but it was a single pilot operation. This was an aircraft that had fewer than 10 seat capacity for passengers. So there are a different set of rules that are allowed for aircraft like this. And it's unclear to me, because I haven't looked at the specifics of this, there may not have been a cockpit voice recorder or a flight data recorder on this aircraft.
There wasn't.
In which case, something as imprecise as flight radar or EDSD data from flight radar 24 or wherever may be some of the best information that even the NTSB has. I'm speculating here. The NTSB has not given any briefings on this event. It's unclear if there are any recorded communications between the pilot and air traffic control. There may be, but I'm not aware of any.
One of the things, Todd, John and I have talked on a previous show about this, is that people like to use Flight Radar 24 and FlightAware and things like that. And while, yes, it is a lot of it is based on ADS-B data, there is always issues with the receiver for that data and the smoothing of the programs and things like that. Again, I'm working an accident right now where I know that the airplane crashed on the approach to a runway. But if you look at FlightAware, it shows that not only did the airplane make it to the airport, but in fact was flying past the airport when none of that happened. So we have to take this early information with a grain of salt. We don't want to build a storyline around it because of these disparities. There was weather in the area. So if you look at the Flight Radar 24 data, you could build a storyline with the little jog that's on the approach path before the airport, as depicted in that data, that maybe the pilot was deviating. These are the kinds of things that the NTSB is going to have to ferret out, either through interview or better fidelity data when they get it from the FAA direct.
I can speak directly to the fidelity of some of that data. I happen to have essentially a do-it-yourself Raspberry Pi-based system right here on my windowsill that feeds data to both Flight Radar 24 and FlightAware. So yes, anyone with the basics of putting together electronic parts can put together one of these and feed data to the system. I'm not vetted by the FAA, There's no third party coming in to see whether or not my signals are precise. I'm one of the many tens of thousands of volunteers around the world who put their money toward Raspberry Pis or whatever and put together one of these receivers. And that's how good the data is.
Mm-hmm. Well, the NTSB is certainly going to be challenged with this one to get accurate information. Fortunately, everybody survived. So if the pilot wasn't too traumatized, he will probably be able to give us a lot of good data. But if he did land long, runway condition probably played a big part in this. And one of the things that I thought about since this happened is these Cape Air pilots fly these same routes over and over and over, multiple times every single day. They know the airports, they know the condition of the runways, they're very knowledgeable. And it could be that he chose to land long because he knows that there's standing water on the beginning of the runway. With no control tower, heavy rain on a general aviation airport probably means that there's no general aviation airplanes flying at that point in time. So there's no runway condition reports being broadcast out by other pilots. So he's sort of landing blind, and maybe that's why he held it off to see what the condition of the runway was and touched down and found out it was he was hydroplaning and he needed to go around.
Yeah, I mean, there's again, we can build all sorts of storylines and come up with reasons why. The board, of course, is going to really have to dissect the performance. And like you said, John, while these pilots, are very familiar with these airports and they can and they do it all the time as far as repetition, maybe we have an issue of overconfidence. We have a little bit of an issue of complacency, which, sounds counterintuitive. Because they've done it so many times, they have that high level of confidence. They've been there, they've done that. This is nothing new. The A game wasn't there for this particular pilot. Again, these are the kinds of things that the safety board and the investigators are going to have to ferret out. It may be that because of the pilot's injuries, he may not remember those things. And as Todd was talking about, yes, this airplane, it's an old piston banger airplane. It does not have a flight data recorder. It does not have a cockpit voice recorder. So the facts, conditions, and circumstances are going to have to be reconstructed based on data that is available, ADS-B data. Of course, witnesses exterior to the airplane, if there were any witnesses, any electronic witnesses, that is any kind of security video at the airport that may have captured the landing. And then, of course, very comprehensive interviews with the passengers to see what is fact and fiction. The three of us have dealt with witness interviews in our respective careers. We know that, yes, you're going to get multiple stories, but you also have to have fact and you also have to have physical evidence most of the time to be able to ferret out fact from fiction that you may get from a witness. And so this is going to be a lengthy process, and we expect that the safety board's going to put out at least a prelim report, hopefully very soon, and maybe bring to light some facts that we don't have immediately available to us. But from what I understand and from folks that I know, they're indicating that the airplane likely landed long, hydroplaned, and the pilot chose to try and abandon the approach by doing a go-around. And unfortunately, because of that short runway, may not have gotten the airplane. It was airborne. It's obvious when you look at some of the video that was taken by, I guess, a biker or somebody on a bike path. John, you and I have looked at that video, and I think Todd, you've seen that video as well. In the area of the bike path, which is right before crossing a road and where the airplane came to final rest, those are small branches. Those are not trees. Those are not trees knocked down, which would suggest that that airplane was airborne and was striking the top of the trees as it settled into the trees and came to rest. So now the question is, how high did the pilot get the airplane? And was it but for the fact that he may have tried to abandon that approach late? He wasn't able to get enough altitude to clear the obstructions off the end of the runway.
And I'd like to point out something about the trees that are in this area. This airport is at the tip of Cape Cod. And if you look at a map of Massachusetts, you see this little hook of land going out into the ocean. The airport is right on the tip of that land. So these are not big, huge oaks or anything like that. These are fairly short. And John, you described it best, some sort of scrub tree.
Right. Scrub pine. They're all, yes, all over Cape Cod. It's because of the sandy soil. They don't grow very big.
Yeah. And the aircraft, which was broken up somewhat, the fuselage was largely intact. Both wings exhibited damage and both exhibited fire damage. But typically when you see something go through trees like that, you would think there would be more significant damage. But again, these are fairly small diameter limbs on these trees, so that might have been to their advantage.
And that's again, if he had not gotten the airplane airborne and center punched the airport boundary fence and gone into the trees, the wreckage wouldn't look like that. One, it probably wouldn't have made it that far, even if these are scrub trees, because they still have some diameter. They're 2, 3, 4 inches in diameter. So that would have torn up the airplane a lot more than it was, but it probably would have acted as a barrier from it going as far as it did off the end of the runway. So it is apparent, at least from the available evidence, that the airplane did get airborne. I think the big question is decision-making. We have these aircraft that are flying these routes all the time. And now you have a pilot. What went into the decision-making to attempt that landing? I mean, it's obvious you can execute the approach, which it's apparent that he did. It would have probably been the ILS to runway 7. It was successful because he made it to the airport. But at what point now does a pilot, especially this pilot, make the decision that, yeah, I'm still good to go and things are stabilized and I'm going to make the landing versus this isn't a good situation. Maybe I should just abandon it at the missed approach, or abandon it if he sees the runway pop into view and all of a sudden he's got standing water on it, you know that that's going to be trouble. Again, this isn't like he's landed there the first time. I'm sure that he's landed there multiple times. And all of these pilots are aware of the unique characteristics of each of these runways. So all of these are the kinds of questions that as an investigator, I sure would be asking not only that pilot, but the company. What is the standing procedure? What is the standing policy with regard to evaluating? And of course, we see that there was weather in the area. And while, yes, you're not going to abandon flying to your destination and go to an alternate if the weather isn't reported, below minimums and things like that. Again, where are these thresholds? And I think the board's going to have to answer those kinds of questions. We have both seen, and John, I know that, you know, over the years, especially up in that particular area, we've lost, I mean, Cape Air has lost a couple of airplanes doing the same thing, going into weather. There was a down east, I can't remember if that was a Twin Otter that crashed years ago. But, you know, when are you pushing the envelope? Are we trying to accomplish the mission rather than being prudent? And I think that, again, when you look at the sequence of events, that 2.5 hours sitting on the ground before they left, that's going to be a factor, because most likely it was a weather delay of some sort.
That's what it appears.
Now, one thing about, sorry for interrupting. Go ahead, John.
I was going to say one thing that you didn't mention, Greg, is there, the NTSB is definitely going to be looking to see if these engines were making power. What kind of signs, you know, physical damage should those engines incur going through the trees or when they struck the ground? And they'll probably want to pull them off unless the pilot has some clear recollection. They'll probably want to pull those engines off and make sure that they were running fine.
Yeah. And again, it's going to be, it's really going to it's really going to be something that the passengers are going to have to delineate and provide factual information. Because we don't have any kind of electronic recording device, again, some passengers may say, well, I heard the engine sputter. We all know that airplane engines don't sputter proverbially like that, but or they weren't making power, or it felt like this, or it felt like that. It's going to take a lot of dissection and physical evidence to really corroborate statements that are made, so that we do know the true performance of the aircraft. And then, of course, aircraft performance is going to be an issue. Landing performance. Was that airplane capable of landing on a contaminated runway with sufficient safety margins and things like that? But no matter what airplane or what airport, if that airplane or an airplane lands long, you have now cut that safety margin exponentially, depending on where you've touched down. And on a short runway, you do not have a lot of margin. And on a short contaminated runway, you definitely don't have any safety margins. You have got to be on top of the ball when it comes to where you put that airplane down and how you're going to control it. And then you got to really have plan B in place. That is, how long am I going to let this go and still have a safety margin to abandon the approach?
One thing that strikes me about this event, this investigation, is pretty much what Greg just said. All the things he said, this isn't just an airline issue. Anyone who is in the general aviation community, who's flying at any airport, how often have you flown into an airport, an airstrip that's 3,500 feet or so, that's 100 feet wide or so, doesn't have a tower on it, and where you might have a fairly high performance twin, and you might have a get there itis sort of situation. Human behavior and human performance would have similar issues, whether you're general aviation or an airline. So my advice, when this report comes out and you're flying anything, I don't care what it is from Cessna on up, read this closely. This is an airline event, but I think it's totally relevant to the GA community.
And that's a perfect point, Todd, because when you look at accidents like this, this is a GA airplane for all intent and purposes, you being used in commercial service. I think sometimes, and I've seen it with a number of accidents, is pilots going into their home airport or a very familiar airport think they can't because they already have a familiarity with that particular airport. And GA pilots going into their home airport, dark and stormy night. I know the runway's right there. I know the conditions. I know how long it is and things like that. That tends to factor into their decision-making on a dark and stormy night, whether or not they continue going into that particular airport. I did three accidents. I did a Cessna 206 where the pilot basically had a makeshift approach that he created himself, using waypoints with a GPS. When he got to his last waypoint, then he picked up a heading and he flew for 2 miles. And as long as he stayed on that heading and he was at 500 feet above the ground, he would end up flying to his little airstrip on his property. Unfortunately, he kind of started hunting a little bit for that runway. He had some lights out there. He didn't have formal runway lights, but he had some lights out there. And because he knew the area so well, and I'm getting this from people that I talked to, including his wife, because he knew the airplane airport and the surrounding area so well, he pushed on. Unfortunately, that 500 feet went down to 300 feet, went down to 200 feet as he thought he was getting closer. And the next thing, he hit a power line, and that's all it took. If he had been anywhere else, there's a high probability he wouldn't have done this. But because he was that close to being home, it was his backyard, his familiarity with the area, he thought he could. And these, like John was saying, these guys are flying repetitively into these airports. Is that some, basis for decision-making that I know it, been there, done that, and I'm going to accomplish the mission?
You know, we talked about standing water on the runway and him landing and maybe landing long because of it. but also standing water on the takeoff end of that runway in the direction that he was going could also have slowed him down. Because when you're plowing water, you shed an awful lot of airspeed. So if he was trying to make a go around, his main gear is still on the ground and there's standing water, you hit it, you know, if it's an inch deep and you hit it, you're going to feel it. You're going to lose some velocity.
Yeah.
So, I mean, there's just so much to this accident to be learned. And it's going to be very difficult to ferret it all out. So
I think that the board, hopefully, you know, they will have enough good information. Now it's the interpretation. But again, this accident sequence started before that airplane ever left the ground. And you have to expand it beyond just the wreckage, those passengers and that pilot in the air on the airplane. You have got to look at company policies and procedures. You have got to look at the dispatch and see how and why that airplane was delayed. What changed the decision 2.5 hours later to dispatch that airplane? All of these factor into the entire sequence of events. This isn't, well, the pilot, you know, landed long and screwed up. It goes well beyond that. And there are always lessons to be learned, either by the company to incorporate into a new policy, procedure, or whatever. But like Todd was talking about, it also has a benefit to the general aviation community. Why? Because we can all learn from it. It's a 3,500 foot runway. You're not landing a 737 in there. You're landing airplanes like we fly in the general aviation community, high powered or high performance singles and twins, and even light jets. So, I mean, these are the critical things that we can learn from if the board does its job and does a very thorough and methodical investigation with good, solid evidence.
You know, I also am curious to see what kind of a role dispatch played in this, because Cape Air does have a dispatch system. And what was their role? You know, I always hop on the pilots at the end of every show about pre-planning, doing a good pre-planning your flight. But when you have a dispatch operation, a lot of that's done for the pilot. And, you know, with this delay, did he take a look at the weather himself? Was he monitoring what's going on his route of travel and at Provincetown?
Yeah.
Was he relying upon the dispatch people to get him the information? And in fact, did they get him accurate information? So their role in this is going to be important as well.
And I'd like to point out that pilots clearly are certified by the FAA. They have a license. What requirements does the company or the individual have to be a dispatcher at an airline?
There's a dispatch license.
Yep.
But not everybody that works in dispatch has to have that license. There's a lot of people that do a lot of the mundane work in that type of operation. So you have one or two licensed dispatchers and 1, 2, 3 other people processing all the paperwork, getting the data together for the dispatcher. And especially an operation like Cape Air, where you're in a very compact area. All right, so most of your operation is between Providence, Hyannis, Nantucket, Martha's Vineyard, and Boston, with an occasional run up into Worcester, which is still only a 15-minute, 20-minute flight from Hyannis. Hyannis is their main base. So you have a lot of airplanes going into the same places over and over again. And so a lot of what the dispatcher does is routine. So you have people pulling the weather down for the dispatcher, you know, helpers, if you will, wannabe dispatchers at some point in the future. So you have a lot of that going on. They need to take a look at that. You know,
and
there's a little operation with this. I was just going to say, Greg, you've got a lot of experience with the dispatchers with the Little Rock accident.
Yeah.
It was a major operation, a major airline with dispatch, and the dispatchers hung this guy out to dry in Little Rock.
Yeah. And of course, that's definitely going to be one of those things, because we know the mission is to get people from point A to point B. And, you know, there are these things that we look at in all these commercial type accidents. Was there pressure to go? We saw it in Kobe Bryant. We saw it in a number of other accidents where, even though it may not be spoken pressure, there is self-induced pressure by a pilot to accomplish the mission. And again, workload. Here you got a single pilot operation. Todd was talking about this earlier. You have a single pilot operation on a great day, sunny, you know, blue sky, 102 mile visibility, you know, workload isn't that great. But now you're flying into weather, you've got to set the airplane up and yourself up to fly the approach. So you got to think about making sure that the, you know, you're going to be able to execute the approach, go down the minimums, but you're also thinking about plan B. Now, typically pilots don't factor in that they're going to touch down on a runway and then abandon the landing. Normally it's, you're going to abandon the approach at a prescribed point. But in this particular instance, it's obvious that the pilot had the approach wired. He got to the airport. Now, what happened with the landing? If he did land long, why did he land long? And what were the influencing factors to make him believe that he could abandon that landing and get the airplane out of there safely versus staying on the ground and just going off the end? These are the kinds of things that we're going to have to try and learn from. And hopefully the FAA and the NTSB will be able to get us some good information, because this could have a future impact, not only on the company and their policies and procedures, but it, again, it's something that as a flight instructor will want to talk about and will want to train other pilots. Here's a situation. This is what happened. This is the decision-making. Here are the factors that that pilot used to make that decision. It wasn't appropriate. It wasn't the proper decision, or he should have used more information. All of these can be used as tools, not only for us, but for the individual pilot out there when they do an introspection of, okay, this is my planning, as you always preach, John, in my planning stage. I am going to have to worry about the weather. I am going to be executing the approach and the what if I have to abandon, what am I going to do? And what are my prescribed points that I'm creating for myself? We don't do that enough. And as flight instructors, I've seen that we haven't really taught students to think like that. We talk about taking off or even landing. And we think about, okay, if you're landing, okay, where is that point on the runway that you're going to pick to abandon and say, I'm going to stay on the ground versus try and fly this airplane? Same with the takeoff. If the airplane starts the takeoff roll and you aren't off the ground by a certain place on the airport, then you just shut it all down and stay on the ground. We don't emphasize that enough. And as we've all talked about in multiple shows, and, you know, every aviation publication writes about these things on a regular basis, and that is planning the entire flight with all the alternatives, because the flight isn't just point A to point B. There are so many other external factors that are going to have an influence on your planning, and you have to have that in the back of your head as you take off and as you land.
This is a potential learning opportunity for GA, for airline aviation, whomever can learn from this. And typically what you have when you have a report like this, you have the actual report, which could be varying lengths. It could be a major report, a couple of hundred pages. It could be something that's rather brief. But I believe in this case, as with many of the NTSB investigations, you'll have not only the report, you'll have the public docket. And the public docket might have much more details about certain aspects of the event. So my recommendation, if this is an event that's of interest to you, when this does come out, don't just get the report. Look for anything in the public docket. And also, to a certain extent, the modern era of communication with social media and such, there's stuff out there beyond the NTSB that could be informative. And one of those things was the 30-second or so video I sent there to you. It was shot by an eyewitness. Now, it may not be very important in the investigation, but it may turn out to be that is the best evidence that's out there for certain aspects of the event. So broaden your horizon. Learn from watching shows like this, which you should watch on a regular basis, by the way. Learn from formal reports. Learn even from non-traditional sources of information.
Yeah. Well, the biggest thing is that, again, we're pilots. We are trained to be pilots. There are certain expectations, not only by the FAA, but family, friends, and anybody else that gets in an airplane with you. And you owe it to yourself and to them, and even to the people on the ground near an airport or your the ground that you're overflying. You owe it to all of them to be the complete pilot, not the 70% pilot, not the 60% pilot, not even the 90% pilot, the 100% pilot. That means understanding, doing the pre-planning that John preaches every single show, and doing it thoroughly. That is, have your plan A, have a plan B, and in some cases, you may even need a plan C. It's there. And as long as you have it there and you get into that habit of planning like that, nothing will be a surprise. It could be an inconvenience. It's going to be something that you can deal with, but you're going to deal with it with a high level of confidence and not try to learn it, pardon the pun, on the fly while it's happening.
Yeah. Pre-planning is a big part of it, whether you're an airline or not. You know, and as you were talking about the pre-planning piece and how things change, you know, we've been hopping on the, doing a good pre-flight of the airplane as well as rest. And that email that we've got from an airline pilot that after listening to us, and we've talked about it on one of the shows in much more detail than what I normally just say at the end, that he wrote in and told us that he has changed the way he does his pre-flight based upon some of the pointers that we've made in our shows. And that's what everyone needs to do. You know, I don't like picking up broken airplanes and broken people. I don't like it. And I get out actually angry when it involves kids. Right? Why do we pilots? We know what we have to do. We've got a ton of education in flying, and yet we make some of the dumbest mistakes out there, even dumber than car accidents.
Yeah,
it's just a tragedy.
Well, I've seen some ambivalence, you know, again, and that's why I go back to, if you have the opportunity, go on the FAA website, pull down Advisory Circular 60-22. It's all about aeronautical decision-making. It's 32 pages long, but the FAA has done a great job in characterizing attitudes and basically characteristics of pilots who make good decisions and bad decisions. That not only applies to pilots, it applies to mechanics. I use it even in my regular everyday life because there's some very good information. The fact is that when we look at this kind of thing, this pilot is a professional pilot. So we're not going to already point the finger at him. There were a lot of reasons for what he was trying to do and a lot of reasons for what he wasn't able to do. We have to wait for the investigation process to play out. But when you look at what decisions he was making and the information he was using, that's going to help benefit us. We're very blessed that nobody was killed in this accident. That's the first and foremost thing. But we have to learn from this. You can't just write this, it's just another accident, you know, and you park it in the back of your mind or you blow it off. And, you know, that can't happen to me attitude because I wouldn't do that. I don't fly those airplanes or whatever. It doesn't matter because what you were going to learn out of this accident applies to anything that flies. Why? Because it involves a human and it involves decision making and whether or not there was appropriate information to make an informed decision or an uninformed decision or an improper decision based on a lack of information.
Well, I think we've beaten this to death on what we know so far. We will be back on this accident again, just because it looks like there's going to be a wealth of material there to help the general aviation community. So stay tuned, folks. We will be back.
Well, my friends, it's, again, always good to see you. And I know, John, that I always leave you with the last word. So I'm going to start with Todd. in his last words before I turn it over to you?
Well, the one thing that comes to mind here is this is something that, frankly, it was of interest to me because it happened to be a local story. But as soon as I started scratching the surface, I thought, this isn't just a local thing about a local airline, a small airplane with a non-fatal accident. This has stuff in it that is of use to three of us here, and more importantly, to the community at large, especially the general aviation community, even though this isn't an airline accident. So that's my big takeaway now from all this.
And John, you know, I've already said my 2 cents worth, but again, these are the kinds of accidents that we can learn from and we have to learn from. And I just think that, and I'm working right now on a project where I really want to try and understand better what pilots and their decision-making is all about when it comes to recurrent training. We know that recurrent training, of course, is required in certain aspects of aviation, but for the general aviation pilot, again, we've seen this disregard or this, you know, I don't need to do recurrent training. I fly on a regular basis. I only fly a 172. It doesn't require any kind of real complex formal recurrent training. That's not what it's all about. What it's all about is learning these lessons, these valuable lessons from these incidents and accidents, and then bringing them into your own little world to enhance your skills, to enhance your decision-making. Why? Because it's going to trigger something. Yeah, that guy didn't make that decision. I didn't even think about that. I should use that from now on. I should look a little further in the information. I should follow it a little closer. I should use my tools available, such as my iPad with any of the flight planning tools. I really should monitor the weather on a more realistic or timely basis. All of these things, we can make ourselves better as pilots. And if you shut down and think that I only drive a 172 around the patch every once in a while, I don't need that. You're the guy or gal who really needs it. Why? Because you think you already know it and you don't. And the three of us have been around a long time. We've been involved in aviation. I am learning something new every single day, whether it's through my own flying or because of the work I do, where I have to learn something new because it's outside my wheelhouse and I'm having to dissect it for the purposes of accident investigation and in some cases litigation. So I find it very interesting, very entertaining for me because I go way outside my comfort zone to learn something. And a lot of it is just, I mean, it's like, man, I wish I had known this 10 years ago. So I think that this is a perfect opportunity. So with that, my friend, I will leave you, John, with the last words of the Flight Safety Detective podcast.
Well, the first word is the words that you just used for the pilots also pertain to mechanics. And I can't tell you how many times I've come across mechanics and talk about recurrent training and said, I've been working on Cessnas 172s, 182s type airplanes for 40 years, nothing's changed. I don't need recurrent training. And I get the same thoughts. You know, you are the guy that needs it. And failure to follow procedures in the cockpit, failure to follow procedures in the hangar are still the number one problem in the industry. And if we're also damn smart, why aren't we following the procedures?
Yeah.
Most of the time, those procedures have been written in blood, or in the case of a hangar, they may be blood or they may just be a major costly mistake, but it's just all over. And it seems to be coming back with a vengeance after COVID. Now, I don't know whether that's just because I'm looking harder after COVID or if it really is a spike in the wrong direction that's above what was the norm in 18 or 19. I don't know yet. This time will tell. But I just noticed that there's an awful lot of bad things happening for no apparent reason. So with that, I will remind everybody that this show is brought to you by PAMA, the Professional Aviation Maintenance Organization, as well as Avemco Insurance. If you need insurance, Howell Insurance, insurance for any general aviation airplane, if you need it because you're a flight instructor, and you should have insurance if you're a renter, because if you have a problem there's a deficiency in the insurance coverage, or maybe there isn't any insurance coverage, you're going to be liable for it. So it pays to get it. I've been told it's very inexpensive, but I don't know if that's true or not. But in any event, Avemco is the place to go for all your GA insurance needs. And you get a 5% discount for mentioning Flight Safety Detectives. Now, give them a call. It's 888-879-0389 or avemco.com. And with that, I will remind everybody, if you're going to fly, do a good pre-planning session. Cover all the what-ifs. When you get out to the airplane, do a thorough walk around. Touch your airplane. Don't just walk around and look at it. Touch your airplane. And when you go flying, please fly safely.
Travel is great, but planning for travel can be time-consuming and difficult. That's where One Travel comes in. With One Travel, you'll find everything you need to book the perfect trip. Flights, hotels, cars, transportation, it's all right there. With One Travel, you can book online, via app, or even pick up the phone and talk to a travel advisor ready to help you make your selections. Visit onetravel.com/music or call 855-437-2154. Plan it, book it, live it. One Travel.
Take your family's best trip yet to Denver, where every stroll sparks a smile and where every moment becomes a memory. Where hikes at Red Rocks lead to sweet treats at Little Man Ice Cream. Where you can chase thrills at Elitch Gardens and enter new dimensions at Meow Wolf. It's where dinner always comes with a side of sunshine. Denver, always welcome. Plan your getaway at visitdenver.com/summer.
I won't let my moderate to severe plaque psoriasis symptoms define me.
Emerge as you. In two clinical studies, Tremfya guselkumab, taken by injection, provided 90% clearer skin at 16 weeks in 7 out of 10 adults with moderate to severe plaque psoriasis. In a study, nearly 7 out of 10 patients with 90% clearer skin at 16 weeks were still clearer at 5 years. At 1 year and thereafter, patients and healthcare providers knew that Tremfya was being used. This may have increased results. Results may vary.
Serious allergic reactions may occur. Tremfya may increase your risk of infections and lower your ability to fight them. Before treatment, your doctor should check you for infections and tuberculosis. Tell your doctor if you have an infection or symptoms of infection, including fever, sweats, chills, muscle aches, or cough. Tell your doctor if you had a vaccine or plan to.
Emerge as you. Learn more about Tremfya, including important safety information, at Tremfya.com or call 1-877-578-3527. See our ad in Food & Wine magazine. For patients prescribed Tremfya, cost support may be available.
The most exciting part of a vacation stay at a home rental? Easy. It's being greeted upon arrival with a rusted lockbox affixed to the underside of a stranger's condo. Yeah, you simply twist knobs, click gears, jiggle it, and then rip it off its moorings, and voila! Your prize is a key to a questionable home rental and maybe tetanus. When you just want to get your vacation started by actually getting into your room, it matters where you stay. At Hilton, we deliver your key right to your phone on the Hilton Honors app. Hilton, for the stay.